You're listening to Enthusiasts, a podcast about the most passionate of passionate people. Link in episode description to check out the back catalog, learn more about the show, and check out my other show, 17 Karat K-Pop. This series of episodes tackles themes including depression, suicide, and substance abuse. Please take care when listening, and know the help is out there. Visit NAMI.org, N-A-M-I. Receive more localized support through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 1-800-662-4357. You could also call to talk anytime to a suicide crisis hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Don't want to call? You can text someone. Get 24/7 crisis counselor support, 741-741. You're listening to a series of episodes about the life and legacy of Tony Hsieh. I highly recommend you check out the past parts of this story if you haven't yet. The link is in the episode description. Enjoy the show! 2014 was also big for biohackers, the world of people who wanted to hack their biology, expand their life. So kind of like Tony shifted from trying to solve a concrete, difficult, layered issue to solving a different, more easily definable, relatively more surface level issue that was not in a deep emotional, layered context. Biohackers wanted to solve not the quality of their current life, but skip to a seemingly more logistical focus, which is lengthening it. Being here for a long time, not trying to self-reflect on what's a good time. Popular biohacker types included the grinders, people who implanted chips in themselves to kind of experiment on how it affected them, people who tried injecting themselves. There was David Asprey, who was dubbed the father of biohacking. He got an operation that took stem cells from his bone marrow and injected them back into his body, which he thought would induce a lifespan extension to age 180. There's Rob Reinhart, a 25-year-old who created Soylent, a gross liquid, this beige-colored liquid touted as having the nutritional equivalent of a full meal. Rob claimed to drink this concoction every day, and it was adding years to his life. Lots of big names like Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos were putting money behind researching biohacking-type lifespan-extending initiatives. Those would turn lethal eventually for some, ironically. Famous biohacker Aaron Trawick took ketamine, lost consciousness, and drowned in a sensory deprivation chamber. So 2014, out west, was a year of soul-searching in some dangerous ways, in some important ways in terms of leaning into therapy. It also was a time stressed-out employees and bosses on the West Coast turned to ketamine clinics for psychological reasons. It became a go-to drug among Silicon Valley types because it's not covered by insurance, so the wealthier clientele got into it. Yet, of course, the 2010s of self-exploration and finding fixes for our emotional discomforts have not made the public much happier in some ways. A book came out in 2015 called The Happiness Industry, in which William Davies argues happiness's essence has continuously been reduced by the attempts to quantify and label it. Still, people are searching, and now there are even classes in happiness studies for how to hack your mind, basically. In September 2014, Michelle D'Attilio was dealing with a painful breakup, so her ex, Tony Hsieh, invited her to go with on his trip to Hawaii. This was a special sign of old Tony before things would change. He made her laugh throughout the trip, sometimes intentionally. They listened to music and danced in their seats the whole flight. Sometimes accidentally, he fumbled with cords he brought in his bag. He said to create collisions in the airports, he would travel with a bunch of power cords, so he had an easy in to induce conversation. Classic likable Tony was on full display. But the DTPers in Vegas, with the bar for an office, enabled Tony's sense of reliance on alcohol to loosen up in social settings. But he figured it was actually a better, less addictive alternative if he switched, so he did from alcohol to ketamine. He insisted the research showed ketamine can be non-addictive, which the science does not back up. There's no case where taking it has no risk of addiction. A mix of big moments in this story took place in 2015. One, Zappos' turnover rate rose to nearly 30%. 2, most of the DTP's food and drink portfolio were sold off to Wendo Media. Here's a weird aside, not fun fact. One employee at Wendo Media, Ryan McPherson, was under FBI investigation for importing human body parts from Thailand, then having them shipped to Wendo Media offices. This was also when Tony went to a Necker Island retreat, Richard Branson's island, to give a speech at an event, and he became enamored with the artist Jewel, who performed there. Jewel rose to fame in the 90s. She's a folk singer, and she's dealt with so much. There could be a whole podcast about her, if there isn't already, dealing with abuse, homelessness, mental illness. They really bonded over the shared sense of therapy from things like music, and a search for happiness. Tony turned to her, and eventually she would help set up resources. So DTP employees could have a bunch of mental health tools through a project online called Whole Human. And 2015 was the year Dr. Michael Freeman, psychiatrist and professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, issued a big influential report, Are Entrepreneurs Touched with Fire? Among his findings, entrepreneurs were 2 times as likely to have depression, 3 times as likely to have a substance use disorder, 6 times as likely to have ADHD, and 11 times as likely to be bipolar. A lot of the traits associated with entrepreneurs, big risk-taking, big grand visions, a quickly changing laser focus, attention span, a desire to quickly move from one thing to another, those traits often align with certain mental conditions too. Alfred Lim, one of the OG partners in businesses with Tony, told Amy Groth for her book, quote, he'd never met someone who is really well-adjusted who is an entrepreneur, unquote. Startup Snapshot had quite an analysis as well, reporting that 36% of founders said they struggle with burnout, while only 23% reported getting help for it, therapy, coaching. 81% said they do not open up about these stresses, and 50% said there's a stigma for doing so. Some voices have definitely tried to change that, like Jewel and Brad Feld, an entrepreneur and investor who had this mental health pledge put on his website that he wants founders to take for their companies. In 2016, by then quite a few DTP businesses had closed, and Tony's mind would soon move elsewhere. But first, there was another slew of negative headlines. It had been 4 years since this started, and the returns were not what people had hoped. Lots of places, especially startups, have high turnover, but the amount of people quitting or being fired at the same time, repeatedly, that raised eyebrows. Yet in interviews, Tony and Fred Mossler kept saying, this, if you look at the stats, is on par with a lot of other businesses in the area. The bad coverage, though, of this defining project for Tony's legacy probably contributed to his desire to take more drugs and his disenchantment with life in some ways. Michelle recalls at her birthday party that year, she encouraged Tony to do his famous moonwalk, and he did, reluctantly, and later got mad at her, lashing out like, why'd you make me embarrass myself in front of people? This was the happy-go-lucky guy who used to make other people do the Macarena as part of a job interview initiation, and now he was embarrassed to dance in public. 2016 was also when Medium, the platform, gave up on Holacracy. They said it had gotten way too difficult. In 2017, Tony seemed to keep dealing with criticism of his work by pivoting to organizational makeovers as his focus. Like, don't blame me, blame the system. And that's how he saw the world, as not because he wanted to pass the buck, but more so I see it as that's how he was wired. To think of stuff as, these aren't individual problems, these are systemic problems, systematic ones, so if I tweak the puzzle a certain way, I can get the better answer and crack the code, and all the other emotional, hard-to-understand stuff will naturally solve itself if I just solve this code, this puzzle, that is organization. So he still was working on a Holacracy-type approach, and he kept vouching for it, like with the book Organize for Complexity, by a self-proclaimed enemy of Holacracy, who still advocated, but for a different type of decentralized decision-making. He flew some company members to Berlin to meet the author in person, a German managing consultant, Niels Flaging. Tony paid for their stay at a 5-star hotel, really tried to sweeten the deal when they met with Flagging, who recalled later being surprised how the group wasn't joyful, really, and they stuck to their hotel room. They didn't really want to go out or talk somewhere else, just stay there, like it was a chore. Prior to this, though, their holacracy system had led to the creation of 500 self-governing mini-circles. Meanwhile, Amazon was getting annoyed with Zappos. They had been fine being pretty hands-off over the years, but they wanted growth. Not just making good money as Zappos did, but making more and more money over time. But Tony wasn't focused on boosting sales. He was focused on other stuff. So Tony figured there was a way to boost sales without taking the easy way. So he figured he could do stuff like biohack to be more productive and get more done that would eventually turn into higher revenue. If that doesn't make sense to you, remember, it could have been some ketamine talking. In late 2019, Tony gave a presentation for his friends. He screened a TED Talk by Dr. Rick Doblin, who preached the benefits of ketamine therapy, which has been shown to treat, in some cases, conditions like PTSD, even in otherwise treatment-resistant people. The part of the speech Tony seemed to not remember as much was the part where Dr. Doblin says ketamine should only be taken in a controlled clinical setting by a professional administering it. Tony was so hyped, though, thinking about how his mind could be on another level. He could crack big codes to humanity's biggest issues with the help of ketamine to get on a higher spiritual plane. So he invited Doblin himself to go to Vegas and talk in person, even offering up himself as a future trial participant, which was an offer Doblin did not accept. Tony apparently couldn't really sway people as much as he'd hoped to become ketamine evangelists, so his pivot was from ketamine to nitrous oxide, which a friend Victoria he hired to make videos that would tout its benefits. He paid his friends to do favors for him, so hers was to make documentaries, one a pro-nitrous oxide one, in which there's no disclaimer until the very end. Quote, "It is important to emphasize that we are not advocating the use of general anesthetics as psychedelic drugs. Rather, we're suggesting that the current description of cognitive effects of commonly used anesthetics is likely incomplete." Unquote. Post-ketamine years, time under the influence of nitrous oxide, Tony was thinking quite different and maybe even grander vision-wise, if possible, than ever. Tony himself wasn't just changing, but his inner circle had changed. The people who had stuck with him, befriended him, moved to Vegas for him because of an earnest, agreed, shared set of values, a belief in this renovation project, a desire to create the happiest, most community-oriented, feel-good, friendly place on earth. Those people had left him because they moved out, they'd quit, they lost businesses, they'd grown disillusioned with this guy they saw as their hero for a time. They had left him, they gave up faith in him. The people who were still in his orbit tended to be yes men, tended to be people who still wanted to be part of a party. Not in the wholesome, we're all friendly party sense, but in a he's still really into drugs, let's keep hanging out with him party sense. So these people were down for Tony's worst impulses. Tony wanted to start fresh. He wanted to sever ties with all Vegas properties and start a new system. He moved to Park City, Utah to do it. And once again, he had people fill a post-it wall. You'd write it down, put it on a post-it note. He would sign off on it. Very informal. And once again, people would come to him, pitch ideas all the time, and he would write them checks. In Park City, he was doing a repeat, in some ways, of what the DTP had tried to be. But this time he thought it would work better, because now he wasn't just going to do DTP, he was going to do 10X, a new system, ordered some pals, Justin and Susie, to help implement via post-it note instructions. The first person to help him sell off his Vegas properties would win a 10% commission, another way he gamified tasks he gave people, which was an impulse that often directly pitted people against each other, so the infighting in his inner circle was constant. Sometimes light and playful competition, sometimes pretty serious, like when there was one grant that could go to either person. The fixation on times 10 continued. He wanted to make this Park City renovation 10 times everything compared to the DTP. 10 times bigger, 10 times more happy, 10 times more successful, etc. And he planned to give 10% of commissions to people based on how they spent the checks he gave them. So if you wanted $1,000, he'd give you $1,000 and let you earn $100 from that deal. He also set up a Park City membership program where Park City residents paid $10 a month, and that got them in like special club status to get access to free food and drinks, Tony paying the bill, on designated days. So all these people paid $10 on days where Tony was footing a bill for much more than that per person. The thought was, well, you start with $10, but you increase the membership fee over time as the number of people buying into it increases, as its reputation grows. So at first, this project will lose money, but it will be offset in due time. He also hoped to scale up this project eventually, bringing in more revenue by adding on. So a membership would no longer just be about food and drink for free on certain days, but recreational activities too. One time he even footed the bill for the 10X implementers to celebrate for 5 weeks straight when he rented out a Mexican restaurant from 10 p.m. until closing every night for 5 weeks. Tony kept on feverishly, you could argue, spending and giving tons of his money. By August of 2020, he had bought 9 Park City houses and had written down plans, often via Post-it, to buy over a dozen more properties. One property he bought for $16 million, $1 million more than the asking price. He bought up vacant lots as well. He was spending tens of millions on Park City. He even wrote on Post-it notes ideas he was hatching for how to persuade people to put their homes on the market who weren't doing that. Mimi Pham was in control of his finances at this time. She really had become like a personal secretary in every way, a personal assistant, a go-to person. You go through her to talk to him now. And in 2020, her salary was $360,000, about $30,000 a month. The people who moved into this new Park City attempted utopia ranged a lot. Tony had invited some. Some had invited themselves or asked if they could come. So it was a mix of familiar faces and newbies to create more collisions, creative opportunities with unexpected combinations of people. Some of the characters who were in Tony's world now in Park City included his ex Michelle, Mimi, a weed entrepreneur, Don Calder, a former America's Got Talent contestant, Daniel Park, a former Miss New York contestant and competitive swimmer, Elizabeth Pizzello, Victoria, who he hired to make the mini documentaries on whatever he wanted, people hired to do other odd jobs like run the Blizzy Ranch daily newspaper for a $500,000 salary, a paper named after Blizzy, his beloved dog, Mark Evansvold, who ran a business called Nacho Daddy, a project he asked for money for, and Tony said, sure, move here, do whatever you like under the project manager title for $450,000 a year, and his brother Andy, the one who tried to do his own startup years earlier. It was odd because they'd kind of been distant for years, but Andy came back into his life at this time, supposedly to keep an eye on him, look out for him. But Andy did store and keep stocked a room they called the Treehouse, which was full of canisters of nitrous oxide. In a book about Tony called Wonder Boy, quote, Andy repeatedly asserted that he was there on behalf of the family to make sure people weren't taking advantage of his brother. Privately, Andy had also negotiated for his brother to pay him a $1 million salary. He'd asked for millions more in a series of proposed business deals. He quickly found himself doing what he could to stay in his brother's good graces, which, among other things, meant satisfying demands for more laughing gas, unquote. It seemed to be a mix of the drugs and the change in environment and inner circle. A confluence of influences definitely shaped him, changed him. The Tony of Park City, like a different person than the Tony we've now gotten to know through this series. This Tony took nitrous oxide a lot, to put it mildly. Constant usage of whippets. They're called whippets. It's basically a canister. And he would steadily huff laughing gas throughout the day, as if he was taking sips of coffee. He was doing a lot of paranoid, mixed with dissociative, mixed with just otherwise concerning, irrational behavior. Increasingly reckless decisions. So now he wasn't just writing off checks for projects people pitched via Post-it. Not that kind of, some might argue, reckless risk-taking. But beyond. Promising exorbitant amounts of money just for people to do random stuff for him. Like he would dare people to wake him up at a certain time, to find him during hide-and-seek, and he'd pay you $1 million. He viewed people now as quite transactional, too. Like, if you did something that bugged him, you owed him. When his parents came to visit in 2020, and they encouraged him to go to rehab, he said, "Fine, but every minute I'm in rehab is another minute you have to take an ice bath." He did go to rehab in early 2020, but failed intervention after failed intervention took place throughout the rest of the year. To put a long story very short, it was hard to get through to him after his initial stay at the Cirque Lodge, which had seemed perfect for him, having Buddhist beliefs and that spiritual focus of therapy, perfect for Tony. But he did not last the typical, at least month, clients tend to spend there. He just agreed to a 2-week deal and actually walked out on day 13. He would get quite snippy with people who were worried about him. He would kind of excommunicate them. He cut you off. Some of the people then he stopped talking to included his parents, the fungineer-in-chief Tyler Williams, the author Amy Groth, and many others he used to be quite friendly with. These people were replaced with a new kind of entourage. Tony still wanted a steady stream of visitors, that sense of living in a social hub nonstop, but he was also becoming more reclusive, so he had people come to him. He wasn't going to tour the town now. You just took a shuttle bus, buses he bought that were organized by Mimi, to go visit him, to add to the pitch Post-it wall or go nuts in this fancy schmancy house he owned. Make yourself at home. And people did, pitching all sorts of strange ideas for life there. They put up mirrors everywhere. They set up a giant iguana tank. They pitched ideas like growing their own mushrooms there, delivering each other drinks via drone, teaming up for a partnership with an Indian commune, recruiting A-listers and making it a new movie production hub. They also hid gold around the property like it was a scavenger hunt. Susie pitched a wellness center, a roundabout way to end up giving him mental health support. But when Mimi got wind that this commission went to Susie, one of her enemies, she canceled the project. And Mimi, too, would have transactional reactions. So she had Tony pay her a disloyalty penalty. This so-called disloyalty penalty was for every day Susie stayed on the premises. Now sticky notes were the go-to way to pitch him and communicate in general, because he often was not in meetings anymore, although he was still technically head of Zappos. He was harder and harder to reach via text or email. You had to get a hold of him via Post-it. So then it became kind of a petty system too, where he would give you a ranking, a score about how he felt about you compared to the others. It was never clear who, but one person even wrote on a sticky note names of people as this list of people whose happiness depended on Tony. There were also warnings, like sticky notes saying, in more colorful language, don't tick off Susie, don't tick off Mimi today, etc. Mimi and others became his surrogates, his publicists, his public face. So events were happening, shuttle buses full of people were coming, but Tony could stay out of it and just be busy huffing. He was further separated from really connecting with anyone because he hired a bunch of armed guards and court reporters. He was paranoid, people were defaming him, messing up his story, interfering in his life in ways he couldn't control. Ways that were not part of his equation for how to fix the world. So, armed guards surrounded the property, much to the neighbors' many complaints. And he had court reporters who were paid to transcribe his conversations and follow him and keep a record of what people were saying and doing. The place was much less jovial, much more of an acting, happy all the time farce than it had been before. There may have been more genuine joy behind the hard work in DTP days, and certainly at Zappos. But now in Park City, there was kind of an ominous feel to it, this house full of mirrors and candles. He was now a pyromaniac in a way, obsessed with flames, always had a fire going. The place was also getting really disheveled. Tony decided it went against nature, the natural order of things, to ever pick up trash. Tony's ideas for how to live a better life got more and more absurd, is one way to put it, very grandiose and often troubling. He started to believe he could do stuff that was just impossible. He was one step away from cracking the code to cure COVID, to create world peace, to levitate, to grow a foot, to break out of the simulation. He was increasingly talking like he was in the Matrix. He was about to achieve the perfect flow state, a flow state that would fit with the aura of the flames, but sometimes the water. Sometimes he would run all the water sources in his house to create some sort of waterfall effect. If he thought his flow state was being severely interrupted, he would have big fits, big psychotic break moments, breaking stuff, smashing stuff, and flooding stuff. He also started putting his big ideas like world peace, Matrix, etc. on post-it notes and just everywhere. So he would use Sharpie and the world was his canvas. So often he himself too, he wrote all over himself with Sharpie. He was also really back into walking around barefoot all the time and seemed to really believe he could be superhuman. He didn't need to sleep. He didn't need to do things like urinate the same amount as regular people. He could resist all physical urges per the biohackers he had come to admire. So he would take ice baths, go on long hikes, run on less and less sleep. It was like he had started to gamify everything. His mundane parts of life had been hacked to become a game, as if he was still trying to convince himself, isn't this fun? I'm having fun. I'm making a super happy life. He viewed sleep at this point as cycles, not hours. Like a human needs a certain amount of cycles of sleep, not hours. And somehow the math he did meant certain activities could completely replace your sleep cycle. So like taking a cold shower made up for the fact you skipped one cycle. Besides all the whippet usage, the paranoia, the not sleeping, the further deteriorating because of all that, there were a couple times throughout 2020 where the people around him seemed to try hard to get him to be the old Tony, bring out the inner silliness. There was an infamous boat trip. They went on a boat trip for the day. He ended up, long story short, freaking out, thinking everything was messing with his flow state, drawing on himself in Sharpie, then curling up in a corner under a blanket, looking like he was panicking. They also considered a bus trip, where he walked on in underwear, nothing with him except for a box of crayons. He later would yell, "Stop the bus," freaking out, like again, flow state interrupted, and the world was now going to heck, because he couldn't save it. Times where the old entrepreneur Tony seemed to emerge only to disappear, or just be different than before. Like I said, the smiles, the joy, felt more manufactured, fake than ever. One time he planned to give a pal Ryan a surprise party, a big elaborate party, so he basically decked out his street to look like an old-timey, speakeasy place. He had someone drive Ryan around blindfolded for a while to discombobulate him, as well as have Ryan hold on to this fish, a cold fish, wrapped in paper, then get out of the car and walk through curtains, walls, layers of structures, all supposedly meant to kind of heighten his sense of sensory discombobulation. Sort of like when you spin someone around for Pin the Tail on the Donkey, it's kind of that on steroids. So after that effect, surprise, and they threw Ryan the surprise party. The concerning part was not just the weird, elaborate setup, but it was not his birthday. It was just a party Tony suddenly had the urge to throw. The guests came assuming it was a birthday party, but it was just billed as a party for Ryan. They assumed no one would be so elaborate with the setup for another reason, but surprise. Another time he said, let's get into a family business again. So he got his family in a room, said, let's come up with a new business idea. You guys think of stuff, brainstorm. I gotta go. When I come back, we'll talk about it. He did not come back. Who knows if he forgot this big exciting plan he had just proposed, or if he just lost interest, but he just left them there to talk amongst themselves. Tony's parents left that trip, needless to say, on bad terms. But Andy stayed after Tony said, I will give you $1 million. He also wanted to redecorate his place, tasking a pal, Justin, to give it a makeover and call it the Life is Beautiful House, which was then renamed Welcome House. He wanted a separate abode, tired of the stream of people going to the other house. It didn't matter though, of course, people still came to both houses. Tony's big idea that summer was to have a series of TED Talk-style speeches with a variety of speakers that would air via Twitch. One of the people who agreed to speak for this series for Tony was Gary Lee Price, who interestingly made a work of art called Statue of Responsibility, a work that was inspired by a book called Man's Search for Meaning. While in town to record this, his wife Lisa picked up on concerning signs of addiction, knowing the signs from her son's struggle, and there was not an attempt to cleanly hide away the piles of Whippet canisters. There seemed to be one person left who was not on his payroll, one person he hadn't completely cut out who was not on his payroll, Jewel. Jewel had gotten more hands-on than just the web portal in terms of providing mental health opportunities for people around Tony. She had also taken them on big retreats, but when it came time for those bigger venting sessions, Tony always failed to show up. Yet Jewel got the sense he did have stuff on his mind and wanted to vent, but it was still awkward for him to do so, like it was when he was a little kid. Jewel was devastated and so angry by her visit to Tony's place at the peak of his nitrous oxide habits. She wrote him a very long, emotional letter that I will quote from, skipping around a bit, but I do want to quote quite a bit from it. "I'm going to be blunt. I don't think you are well and in your right mind. I think you are taking too many drugs that cause you to dissociate. Your intelligence is formidable, but I see you creating rationalizations that are ludicrous and medically unsound. And the people you are surrounding yourself with are either ignorant or willing to be complicit in you killing yourself. You will not hack sleep, and you will not outsmart nature. When you look around and realize that every single person around you is on your payroll, then you are in trouble. If the world could see how you are living, they would not see you as a tech visionary. They would see you as a drug-addicted man who is a cliche. And that's not how you should go down or be known. Please don't be like the stereotype of a billionaire who surrounds himself with yes-men and goes from eccentric to madness, but never sees the line that is crossed because he won't listen to anyone that loves him. Your brilliance for creating connection is killed by the fantasy world you are living in. If you want to save this planet, come back to Earth. I am here to help in any way I can." Unquote. It's not clear why, maybe a cry for help, but Tony dictated to Michelle post that letter to my social media, which she refused to do. However, the letter was put up in the lodge window and mocked mercilessly. People put post-its all around it with bubble letter quotes from the letter, like, "I'm going to be blunt and it was great seeing you," just mocking the heck out of this really heartfelt letter. The increasing frustration with Zappos' stalled sales growth, combined with Tony's unreliability now and erratic behavior that didn't seem to be going away anytime soon, those things combined to essentially oust him. Quite a mix of interpretations of how it went down, but retired, quit, forced out directly, indirectly, whatever happened, it went down mid-August 2020. Tony was out at Zappos, buyouts were offered to staff who wanted to leave as a result, and more Zappos employees took the buyouts then than they had post-Holacracy implementation. They really were there for Tony in his specific vision. They thought the future of Zappos looked bleak with someone else. And indeed, the replacement they found didn't last long. A mix of interesting turns of events happened in October 2020. One thing that happened was United Brands was ordered to pay a $50,000 civil judgment for failure to stop minors from buying nitrous oxide cartridges and for failure to put health warnings on them. That was also the month Tony bought Zappos' City Hall headquarters for $65 million, nearly four times the price of the original purchase. It was also the month he went to go see an old friend, Brock Pierce, campaign for president. Let's pause here and get ready for the next chapter of this story, coming very soon. Be sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it.